And
go ahead.
We have it here now, here at the old Bob and Ray studio, Studio 2 today.
Good to be back, too. It seems like home here.
People have asked us about the opening of the door ceremony on Monday. We don't broadcast that. We just broadcast the closing of the door ceremony on Friday.
Why is that, Ray?
Well, because we just don't think it's worthy of broadcasting.
Well, it's just as formal a ceremony.
We have to do it before we go on the air, you understand?
Oh, right. So we can be here, yeah.
It would be during the editorial
when
it was going on today.
Oh, it was?
Yeah, they were opening the door.
Oh.
Anyway, this is Monday, and today we have some guests here in the studio whose recent exploits were the subject of newspaper feature stories from coast to coast.
And the trouble is, some of those stories never, we never know how they turn out. They just don't follow them up, and we invite the people here to tell us how they came out. And our first guest is Mr. Howard Tipley, I think. Is that right, sir, of Logan, Utah? You, Mr. Tipley?
Yes, I am.
It was the Associated Press, I believe, that put your story on the wire from Las Vegas after you rolled a 7 at one of the dice tables 23 times in a row.
Yeah, boy. It was one of those rags to riches stories that the papers love to print.
Oh, they do, yeah.
I started with 50 cents and ran my bankroll up to $12 million in less than half an hour.
Boy.
Nobody before me had even come close to doing that in a Las Vegas casino.
Well, I'm sure the odds against winning at the dice table 23 times in a row must be astronomical. No wonder AP picked up your story, but I'm sure it left people wondering what a person does after they win $12 million in Las Vegas. Did you need police protection to help you leave town with the money?
No, as a matter of fact, the casino operators got the police to keep me from leaving town.
Uh-huh.
You see, I slipped my own crooked dice into the game.
Uh-huh.
And they kept coming up 7, even when they were dropped off the top of one of the hotels out there.
In other words, you were shown to be a fraud before you even got your hands on the money, huh?
Well, yes. I think one of the casino bosses had taken a math course in high school, and he figured out that what I'd done would only happen by chance once in every trillion years.
Mm.
So that made him suspicious. And now, instead of getting a lot of money, I'm getting 10 years in the pokey for fraud.
Well, that makes your story quite a bit less fascinating than it was originally. But thanks for using your last few days of freedom to come here and telling us the ending anyway.
Fine.
And let's move over for another feature story follow-up to Mrs. Ellie Strombo of Winona, Minnesota. Was it UPI? Yes, it carried your story. Was UPI, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah, but it wasn't just a story. They also carried a picture of me holding the letter I'd received from my late mother that was written in 1937.
Well, now, that was the subject of the article that appeared about you, Mrs. Strombo. Your mother lived in the neighboring town of Red Wing, Minnesota, but it took 39 years for a letter she wrote to be delivered to you. So an alert reporter poked some good-natured fun at the Postal Service, didn't he?
Yes, and I'm kind of sorry it happened. Now, you see, it was really my uncle in Red Wing who found the letter stuffed under a couch cushion where it had been lost for 39 years. And after Uncle dropped it in the mail, the Postal Service only took 2 days to deliver it.
Oh, it wasn't the post office that misplaced the letter at all.
No, it wasn't. And now our local postmaster is kind of peeved at me for making him a laughingstock. But my story had already appeared in 500 newspapers, coast to coast, before I noticed that the old letter had come in an envelope with a 1976 stamp and postmark on it.
Well, that certainly tends to make your story fall flat, dear lady. But thanks for coming to New York to tell us how the mix-up occurred right within your own family. And now, just time for a final feature story follow-up. Here's Mr. Jason Arnstrope of Galveston, Texas. And it was also UPI that ran your story of the drama and romance of buried treasure, right, sir?
Yes. I found a map in an old trunk that had belonged to my great-grandfather.
Mm-hmm.
And it clearly indicated that he had buried a chest full of treasure on the beach near my home in Galveston. So I went out and I dug it up. And that's when the UPI ran my story.
I have a copy of that original story right here, Mr. Arnstrope. Says that the chest was filled with corroded silver coins that apparently had been buried by Spanish pirates in the 1600s. Have you learned the exotic details of that story, sir?
Yes, the exotic details are that the guys I play poker with on Friday night are practical jokers. So they filled a chest up with corroded plumbing washes and buried it. And then they left a phony treasure map where I'd be bound to find it. Now, they're laughing themselves silly because I fell for the trick.
I guess this whole turn of events has made you feel pretty silly, huh?
Yes, it really has. I feel like a complete fool for getting my name in almost 1,000 newspapers around the world when I was really just the butt of a practical joke.
Well, I'm sure you're being a good sport about it.
No, actually, I'm not. The guys who pulled off the stunt were all employees of mine. So I not only fired them, I've also exerted pressure to see that they never work within 100 miles of Galveston, Texas again. I'm really vindictive when a thing like this happens.
Well, I can see you've gone to a great deal of trouble to ruin the lives of those who played this little joke on you, but it's been interesting to hear how the story came out. Thank you and all of our other guests for being with us today on Feature Story Follow-Ups.
Feel the seconds, feel each minute. As the day goes by, feel yourself in it. It's a good day to up and fly away. It's so easy to do. Eastern's got the right time and the right place.
If the right place for you is Atlanta, Houston, or New Orleans, Eastern Airlines has the right time for you. Eastern has 13 nonstops every business day to Atlanta, 3 daily nonstops to New Orleans, and the most nonstops to Houston. So if Atlanta, Houston, or New Orleans is the right place for you, call your travel agent. Or call Eastern, the wings of man.
Eastern's got the right.
Backstage Noble Wife, the story of America's favorite family of the Footlights and of their fight for security and happiness against the concrete heart of Broadway. In our last episode, Mary, Harry, Pop, and Calvin decided to return to their hotel, the Raphael, on foot after visiting La Scala Opera House, where they'll open soon. And it's a short while later now, about half a mile away from the Opera House, as we hear Calvin say...
Yes, sir. You just stay with me. I'll walk you right straight back to the Raphael.
Well, it looks like you know the way back, Calvin. I'll say that for you. Really making a beeline for someplace. Well, I hope it's the hotel.
Yeah, well,
yes,
don't worry about
too.
It. I wish I knew the language. You know, when you...
It's Italian.
Oh, I know it's Italian, but I mean, I wish I could talk it.
Oh, yes, it would be a big help.
You know, it's a shame when you go away. You miss half the fun.
Well, step on the curb here, Calvin. Watch that.
Yeah.
Car's kind of...
Watch where you're going, buddy. Well, he doesn't know what I'm saying either, probably.
That's right. If he did, he might...
Now, come on, we go down this street now.
How'd you just happen to pick this street, Calvin?
I tell you, I've been here before. I think maybe in another life.
As what? What do you suppose you were? A cat? A dog? Something like that?
No, I think I probably was a Roman gladiator.
Either that or maybe a gondolier.
What's that?
Not in Venice, not in Milan, he wouldn't be a...
What's a gondolier?
One of those fellows who pulls those boats in the canals in Venice, you know?
Pulls the boat? Well, you mean asking who they're going to vote for?
No. He makes the boat go with a big oar, a single oar.
Oh? I don't think I'm familiar with that.
Well, they're in Venice anyway. They're not here.
Hey, what?
Oh, I just missed it. Mary, you all right?
Where is Mary?
Mary? She was with us a moment ago.
Mary?
Mary? Mary? Well, we better stop. No.
I told her to follow us.
Yes, we were trying to stay together here. We turned right back there at that corner.
Well, we better double back to where we were.
Now, come on, hurry. This is terrible if we've lost Mary, much less...
She doesn't know a word of the language either.
Doesn't know the language, doesn't know where we're going, because we don't either, except Calvin thinks he does.
She couldn't even ask directions.
No, well, maybe she could make herself understood that she... could use signal language like she's going to her hotel.
Is that it? No.
No.
Thought for a minute that was
now. We're up to the end of the street. I don't see her in that direction.
Mary?
I don't see her in that direction. Mary? Mary?
Mary?
Well, that's not going to do any good, Calvin. She's certainly too far away from us to hear us call.
This is too bad, isn't it?
Well, why would she do that? We're all walking. Oh, there's a policeman. Maybe he can help us.
Officer?
Officer?
This is backstage. His wife is missing. He was walking...
He's walking away.
He didn't know either.
And so, Harry, Calvin, and Pop look around excitedly, having discovered that Mary is missing. You want to join us tomorrow when we'll hear Greg Marlowe say,
"Where is Mary?"
That's tomorrow in the next exciting episode of Mary Backstage Noble Wife. Word Carr speaking. And now the Auburn Motor Company, maker of fine cars up to but not including 1938, brings you another episode of The Gathering Dusk. The heartwarming story of a girl whose fear of living is surpassed only by her fear of doing anything else. As we look in on the Bessinger household today, Edna is chopping down her geraniums on the back sun porch. It's late afternoon, and Mr. Claflin, the superintendent of the village animal shelter, is just arriving.
Oh, it's you, village animal shelter superintendent Claflin. I do hope you got all your animals safely sheltered before you rushed over here to answer my urgent call.
Well, we always keep them sheltered, Miss Bessinger. Our indoor facilities are the only ones we have.
Is that a fact? Mm. Your building appears to be rather small from the outside, and I'd think you'd be terribly cramped for space if you had to handle more than 3 or 4 homeless elephants at the same time.
Well, nobody's ever brought a homeless elephant to the village shelter. We get mostly small animals like dogs and cats. And then around Easter, there are always a few baby chicks and rabbits that have been given to children as presents.
That's very interesting. Would you happen to have a chicken left over from last Easter that's grown up now? I'd be happy to take it off your hands. I don't have a thing in the house for next Sunday's dinner.
Well, we don't give animals away to be used for food, Miss Bessinger. We try to place them in good homes where they'll be taken care of as pets.
Well, I really wouldn't want a chicken for a pet. I remember Daddy gave me one for a present when I was a little bit of a thing and turned out to be a terrible disappointment. I couldn't even train it to bark when strangers came in the yard.
You tried to teach a chicken how to bark?
Well, I didn't really care whether it barked, just so it protected the property. I remember standing out on the porch and shouting, "Kill!" whenever the postman started up the walk, but the chicken never learned to do a thing.
Well, it's not the type of animal it would attack on command.
I suppose you're right. That's a terrible shame. It wasn't more than a month after I gave up trying to train Biddy that somebody stole my roller skates out of the yard. I've never gotten over that tragic loss. I've often thought how it might have been prevented if I'd only had a chicken that was more vicious.
Well, I don't think it does much good to dwell on what might have been. And I hope that's not the only thing you call me over here to talk about.
No, I have a much more urgent matter in my mind, Village Animal Shelter Superintendent Claflin. The people next door have bought a great big dog, and I just know he'll go for my throat the minute I step out in the yard. So I want you to drag him off to the animal shelter before he has the chance.
Well, we do try to protect citizens against dangerous animals. Has his dog made a move against you that would justify a formal complaint?
No, not yet. So far, they've been keeping him in the house, but I know he'll attack as soon as they let him out. He's always poking his head through the living room wall over there and glaring right out the window at me. I'm simply terrified.
Yes, I'm sure you are. Did you say the dog poked his head through the living room wall?
Yes, you can see him over there right now. Apparently, the Fergusons locked him in their dining room. But he's such a strong brute that he stuck his head right through the wall into the living room.
Well, I see the animal you're talking about, Miss Bessinger. But that's not a dog. It's just a stuffed moose head hanging over the mantel.
Oh, my stars and garters, I do believe you're right, Village Animal Shelter Superintendent Claflin. I thought that thing on his head was the rib cage of his last human victim. But I can see now that it's a set of antlers. My, you can't imagine what a terrible worry this lifts from my mind. I almost feel as if I'm no longer standing in the gathering dusk.
Can it be that Edna's freedom from fear of a big dog next door may at last enable her to find true happiness? Or will it only lead to further heartbreak when she realizes that a moose can be vicious too? Join us for the next episode when Edna may shoot the neighbor's wall decoration in the gathering dusk. And down here at this hour, which is 9 before 5, no reports of any problems on the...
I didn't say whether he won or lost or anything. He just ignores that.
I don't think he wants to go into that.
I guess not. He'd have told us. If he'd won, I'm sure he would have told us. Don't you think?
I don't. I just want to make the rest of them look bad.
Probably, that's it.
Dear, if we had some flash kids, we could take some pictures tonight if we had a camera, but we don't have any film.
You're fine, but where could we get it developed?
The Photomat Store.
The Photomat Store sells good fresh film, flash cubes, and cameras. In fact, everything you need for pictures.
We're twins, and we want reprints.
The Photomat Store.
The Photomat Store makes reprints, enlargements, and offers you a choice of print finishes.
I'm not happy with the way my picture turned out.
Your last name, sir?
Gray.
And your first name?
Dorian.
The Photomat Store also develops pictures to your complete satisfaction or your money back.
I got a picture problem.
We got the developing solution.
The Photomat Store.
The Photomat Store is expanding its sale on print and slide film. Save when you buy two. Save even more when you buy four. For instance, four rolls of Photomat 126 12 exposure color print film is just $2.99. Save a buck at the Photomat Store.
And now the makers of Einbind Apply Paper, a name you've gradually grown to trust over the course of three generations, invite you to ride with the men of Squad Car 119.
My name's Sam Finch. Me and my partner, Ralph R. Kruger Jr., are the unsung heroes of the police force. We ride a prowl car at night. Sometimes the weather's hot in Los Angeles, other times it isn't. Either way, we keep on the lookout for trouble. The other evening, it was hot in Los Angeles. We just made a quick stop for some cooling refreshment when my partner, Ralph R. Kruger Jr., turned to me and said,
"Can I have your popsicle stick after you're through with the popsicle, Sam?"
"Yeah, I guess so. I don't have much use for a popsicle stick after I'm through with the popsicle. What do you want it for, Ralph R. Jr.?"
"I need it for the Lincoln Memorial, Sam."
"Oh, you send popsicle sticks to the Lincoln Memorial?"
"No, Sam. I'm building a model of the Lincoln Memorial at home out of popsicle sticks. I need about 12,000 more to finish the job."
"Yeah, that's a lot of them. Why are you building a model of the Lincoln Memorial out of popsicle sticks, Ralph R. Jr.?"
"I had no choice, Sam. A guy in Ohio has already finished a model of the White House made out of popsicle sticks."
"Guess you never thought of a Jefferson Memorial, huh? Could have made one out of..."
"Calling Car 119, Car 119. An arson investigation at 4426 East Rimpaw Boulevard. Meet your commanding officer at the scene of the crime, 119.
4426 East Rimpaw Boulevard,
That's
huh?"
"That's us, Sam. Let's roll."
"Yeah, I guess we'll have to. I really hate to meet our commanding officer tonight, though, Ralph R. Jr. Look how this popsicle has dripped on the leg of my pants. He's not going to like that."
"You're right, Sam. He's not going to like that. The dripping was an accident, but you ate the popsicle on purpose."
"Yeah.
The old man could say that's conduct unbecoming an officer."
"That's pretty much the way I look at it, Ralph R. Jr. But having a popsicle stain on your pants is conduct unbecoming an officer, too."
"Not if it was an accident, Sam. Just eating a popsicle in the first place, that's conduct unbecoming an officer."
"Maybe I could tell the old man it was somebody else's popsicle that dripped on my pants."
"Maybe, but then you'd be lying to him, Sam, and I'm not sure, but telling lies may be conduct unbecoming an officer."
"Yeah, could be. Guess my best bet is to stand with this side of me away from the streetlight. Maybe the old man won't notice the stain on my pants leg."
"That's only got a 50% chance of working, Sam. If the old man is facing the wrong direction, that could leave you standing with your back to him. And I'm pretty sure that's conduct unbecoming an officer."
"Yeah, that would be, facing the wrong direction."
"Car 119, Car 119, disregard that call to meet your commanding officer on an arson investigation at 4426 East Rimpaw. The case has been handled by the men of Squad Car 85. The suspects have been apprehended, booked, and brought to trial. In 1 minute, the results of that trial."
And while we wait to hear the outcome of today's exciting case, here's a timely reminder for housewives from the makers of Einbinder Flypaper. Ladies, it's getting closer to St. Patrick's Day than you might have realized, and now's the time to be stocking up on festive green flypaper for the occasion. Now don't let the big day suddenly dawn and find you with dark, drab, gray, or tan winter flypaper still drooping from your ceiling. Get in the holiday spirit now. And don't worry if you aren't Irish, neither is the Einbinder family. Yet, you've gradually grown to trust their flypaper over the course of three generations.
In that arson investigation on East Rimpaw, two suspects were found to have kerosene in their possession, and Officer Finch was found to have orange popsicle on his pants leg. The case is now being handled according to the laws of the state of California.
And so another band of desperate criminals is brought to justice thanks to the unsung heroes of the police force, the men who ride the squad cars at night.
Now more Bob and Ray and Radio New York over WOR New York.
Well, all right, John. Thank you. And John says the full moon is for lovers. I always thought it was for vampires and oddballs and things, right?
Well, he's still on his honeymoon, I think.
I guess maybe. Good old radio, John. It's always good to hear him. We're back here in our big studio, and looking out our picture window, I can see helicopter 710 way out there.
Beautiful night for it.
Yeah. Fred Feldman will be on a little bit later, telling us about the traffic, and the backstages will be here in a few moments. And right now, we have Fred Falvey here, right?
Right, right.
Now it's time, once again, to pick up some tips for all you home handymen as we pay another of our regular visits to the basement workshop of Fred Falvey, the do-it-yourself. Fred, I'm glad I found you at home today. When I saw those rolled-up newspapers out in your front yard, I was afraid you might be away on vacation.
No, Ray. I rolled up all those papers and scattered them around the yard about a week ago. It's part of a do-it-yourself project I'm involved in.
Well, I can't imagine what it is, Fred, unless it has something to do with all the burglars you'll attract by creating the impression that you're away from home.
No, I admit having all those rolled-up papers in the yard does attract a few prowlers who think the place is deserted, but what little they steal is more often offset by the money I save from leaving papers out there until they get good and soggy.
You just leave them out there in the rain and snow until that happens?
That's right. See, the idea is to let nature convert the newspapers back into wood pulp. And you can burn them in the fireplace just like logs. Only the cost is much less, of course.
Well, certainly sounds like another wonderful example of better living by doing it yourself, Fred. How long does it take for the natural elements to turn newspapers back into wood pulp?
Well, I'm not really sure, Ray. I read in a book where it would take about 200,000 years for paper to become converted into coal.
Yeah.
But I'm certain changing it into wood pulp wouldn't take near that long.
Well, then I suppose it could even happen within your lifetime.
I doubt it.
And it'll be a real money saver if it does. Now, I know that all our beloved friends of the radio audience are anxious to hear about the do-it-yourself project that you've chosen to describe for them today.
Well, I know how much we all enjoy working jigsaw puzzles to pass the time on these cold winter evenings, but very few handymen realize that they don't have to buy their puzzles ready-made. It's quite easy to create your own in the basement workshop using some inexpensive supplies and a few simple tools.
Well, I imagine the primary tool you'd need to make a jigsaw puzzle would be a jigsaw, wouldn't it, Fred?
No. I'm afraid you're getting ahead of yourself there, Ray. First, you have to find an art gallery that's closing out its stock of pictures very inexpensively. Then you have to remove the canvas you select from its frame and glue it on a piece of heavy cardboard stock.
And I suppose you glue it on the cardboard so you can cut it with a jigsaw.
Ray, I can see you haven't had much occasion to work with a painting on canvas that's been taken out of its frame. The canvas tends to curl up almost immediately. So you glue it to a piece of good, heavy cardboard stock to hold it flat. Then I want to show you how to make it into a puzzle by running it through this machine here.
Well, that machine is just an ordinary jigsaw, isn't it, Fred?
I know, Ray. This is a jigsaw equipped with a special double-aught blade. If you used an ordinary blade on a painting like this, it would get all frayed around the edges.
I see. I didn't know you needed a special jigsaw to make a jigsaw puzzle.
It's not the jigsaw that's special, Ray. It's the jigsaw blade. That's a double-aught blade in there.
Uh-huh.
Notice what a neat job it does now when I use it to cut up a picture.
Oh, yeah.
See that?
Yeah, I can see those edges are crisp and sharp. Also, I notice that you're constantly moving the picture around as it passes by the saw blade. I suppose that's to make sure it gets cut up in odd shape pieces.
Yes, that's right, yes.
Yeah.
No point in cutting up a picture in pieces that are just straight across and straight up and down.
No.
You only wind up with a jigsaw puzzle that any child can put together in 5 minutes.
Well, I think you've done enough there for us to get the idea of how a jigsaw puzzle should be made. You just rotate the picture around to make irregular pieces. And I see you also keep the pieces very small.
Yes, I do, Ray. This painting was about 2 feet square when I started, and it'll be in at least 500 little pieces before I'm finished cutting it up. That way I can look forward to about a week of pleasant diversion putting the puzzle back together again.
Yes, I'm sure it'll take at least that long, and I presume the cost is, much lower than you'd have to pay if you went into a store and, bought a jigsaw puzzle ready-made.
Well, I haven't priced ready-made puzzles for several years, but I got this painting I'm cutting up for only $30. It had been $100, but the gallery marked it down because people don't seem to want oil paintings of girls sitting in swings anymore.
Well, that may be, but it's an ideal picture for a jigsaw puzzle. So, once again, we've seen a perfect example of how to live better by doing it yourself. Presented direct from the Basement Workshop for Fred Falvey, the do-it-yourselfer.
Mushies, the great new cereal that gets soggy even without milk or cream, brings you another exciting story of adventure starring Tippy, the Wonder Dog. As we look in on the isolated cabin of Grandpa Witherspoon today, we find that an unearthly quiet has settled over the house. Gramps is lying on his cot, seeking to shut out the problems of the world by facing the wall. Meantime, little Jasper stands in the front window, gazing out across the valley. Suddenly, the boy turns and speaks.
I'm just standing here, gazing out across the valley, because an unearthly quiet has settled over the house, Gramps.
Yeah, concern at all. Why shouldn't there be an unearthly quiet settle over the house? The apple pie I baked is in the pantry, getting staler by the minute. Nobody's seen hide nor hair of that fool dog of yours since I sent him out to get cheese to put on the pie.
Ah, gee whiz, Gramps. If that's all that's bothering you, I can lift your burden of worry right now. A simple mission like bringing home cheese is no challenge at all to a fine animal of Tippy's caliber. Why, he's the dandiest, the smartest dog in the whole wide world.
Well, concern it all, why doesn't he come home before the pie gets stale? Been gone on that errand ever since I finished picking the apples off our tree. That was the 16th of last October.
Well, you know how it is, Gramps. You've always favored a mild Wisconsin cheddar to go on your apple pie. But the clerk down at the general store might have reckoned Monterey Jack or even New York Snappy. And, of course, that would require Tippy to enter into the decision-making process. But it'll all come out fine. Tippy's the wisest, the smart... Wait, look yonder. I think I see him out there now, Gramps, rushing home to save us again.
Here, Tippy, Tippy, Tippy.
Well, concern it all. Let me have that cheese, quick. The fool dog buy it sliced or unsliced?
That's hard to say, Gramps. Figure I saw streaking down the road wasn't Tippy after all. It was just that basset hound of the Mullers. He was headed home with a large bowl of egg whites.
Oh, that means old lady Muller's making her pecan divinity again. Best I can do is apple pie. And I can't even enjoy that because of a fool dog.
Ah, now, Gramps, don't be dragging Tippy's good name through the mud just because you can't stand to eat your apple pie plain. He won't let you down. Tippy's the dependablest, the smartest, the... Wait, I see him out there now.
Here, Tippy, Tippy, Tippy.
Concern it all, I hope the fool dog brought the right kind. My mouth's been watering for Wisconsin cheddar ever since I baked that pie way before Christmas.
I'm afraid you'll have to wait a little longer, Gramps. That wasn't Tippy out there after all. It was just that baby kitten that hangs around the Watson place. He was headed up that way with a half a gallon of chocolate chip ice cream and a bucket of marshmallow topping.
And son at all, that kitten's barely old enough to have its eyes open. But it can still be sent out to fetch a dessert treat that I'd never trust to that fool Tippy.
Ah, Gramps, when you get the craving for sweets, you always go wild and turn against those who love you, like Tippy. But he'll never hold it against you. He's the forgivingest, the smartest. Oh, well, I see him out there for sure now, racing over hill and dale to restore tranquility to our modest home.
Come on in, Tippy. That's a good old boy.
Let me have that package of cheese before the pie crust gets too soggy.
Sorry, Grass, but this doesn't seem to be cheese that Tippy brought home with him. See, it's a giant tube of fluoridated toothpaste.
Concern and all. I'm going to dispatch that fool mutt to the dog pound with orders to give himself up.
No, wait, Gramps. Tippy's trying to deliver a vital message. He must have seen how much sugar you were putting in the apple pie when you baked it. So he brought home fluoridated toothpaste to help you fight the ravages of tooth decay. Hey, oh, boy. Didn't I tell you, Gramps, that Tippy's the wonderfulest, the smartest dog in the whole wide world?
Today's exciting story has been brought to you by Mushies, the great new cereal that gets soggy even without milk or cream. Join us soon for more thrilling adventures starring Tippy, the Wonder Dog.
And now it's time for another story of drama and tense emotion. A tale well designed to keep you in anxiety. And here with us again to set the stage for our latest thriller is the noted lecturer and world traveler, Commander Neville Putney. Commander, I presume you've reached into your amazing file and brought forth another tale well designed to keep us all in anxiety.
Yes, indeed so, young man, and I dare say it's a yarn that will jolly well make your hair stand on end. The two central figures are two young men named Willard Crenshaw and Millard Shawcross. The pair obtained a sailing boat of medium size for what they considered a bargain figure, and they jovially set out on their first voyage, never dreaming that it would bring them face to face with anxiety. Millard and Willard's first trip in their new sailing vessel was destined to cover some 800 miles. But they made less than half that distance when Millard turned to his friend with more than a little apprehension and spoke.
Willard, I'm afraid there may be more than a little apprehension in my voice as I speak, but I've noticed that the boat has been listing more and more to port side for the past hour or so.
Actually, it's listing to starboard, Millard. You're facing the back, so that just makes it seem like port side to you.
Oh, I guess you're right, Willard. And I suppose that proves I'm not much of a seaman. You never should have set out on a trip of 800 miles with no one else aboard except me. I'm just too green at this sort of thing.
Now, don't be hard on yourself, Millard. After all, I was the one who just assumed we'd gotten a bargain when we bought this old tub. I didn't even take time to check it out carefully. That's why we find ourselves in this kind of a fix right now.
Tell me straight, Willard. Just what kind of a fix are we in now?
Well, as you say, she's listing badly, and I've done everything I can to correct the condition. I've lowered the jib and even hoisted the lanyard. But nothing helps.
Have you tried shivering the timbers?
That wouldn't help. You're even greener at this thing than I thought. But you're going to have to face reality whether you understand it or not, Millard. This boat is bound to tip farther and farther to starboard until it flips topside down.
Topside down? That means we'll be thrown overboard. And we don't even have any emergency equipment on hand.
I know, but don't blame yourself for that, Millard. I was the one who should have checked out the facilities, so if it'll make the forthcoming disaster any easier to face, well, you can blame it on me.
No, I wouldn't think of doing that, Willard. This is no time for recrimination. We'll face the future together, without hope, and without life jackets aboard.
Well, there. How about that for a bit of a thriller, young man?
Oh, boy. It really had me in a state of anxiety, Commander. But I've got to hear how the story came out. Were Willard and Millard lost and never seen again with their sailboat finally tipped over?
No, as good fortune would have it, the boat never tipped over. You see, the truck driver had to stop for gas, and our friends were able to get down and tighten a few ropes that set things right again.
Wait a minute. How did a truck driver get into this? You said Millard and Willard were hundreds of miles out to sea.
I beg to differ, young man. I distinctly said they were making an 800-mile trip by boat, but I said nothing about the boat being in the water. Actually, they were having it hauled to the west coast by truck from central New Mexico, where they bought it. Naturally, a good storyteller would leave out that detail to create a more suspenseful yarn.
Well, a cheap fraud would do that same thing, you know, in the hope of making a dumb, pointless story seem exciting.
Are you insolent young pup? How dare you speak that way to an officer of my rank?
I'm not even sure anymore what your rank is. Suddenly, I don't believe anything you've ever told me.
Now, that'll be quite enough of your insubordination. Now, read the closing announcement. Be quick about it.
Wow, okay. I sure feel foolish going through this copy, considering what's just happened.
Read it.
With anything to get this nightmare over with. Friends, be sure to join us next time when Commander Putney will again reach into his amazing file and bring forth a tale well designed to keep you in anxiety.
Hi, this is Orson Bean for your postal service. I just bought my godmother Abigail one of those, whoops, sorry I missed your birthday cards. Actually, it's the second card I'm sending her this week. See, the first one would have gotten there in time, only I botched up her address. So it came back stamped, addressee unknown, return to sender. I accidentally wrote in my friend Abner's address instead of my godmother Abigail's. It's a good thing I didn't botch up my return address. Actually, the post office says over 10 million pieces of mail are misaddressed every day. Sometimes they can piece the clues together and deliver it anyway. Only chances are it's going to be delayed. In fact, all that extra mail going back and forth slows things up for everybody. So this time around, I'm going to be a little more careful. I'll write in Godmother Abigail's complete name and address, nice and neat, include the zip, and of course I'll put down my return address again. There, perfect. Now, when a letter's addressed like that, it helps the Postal Service work better for everybody.
Time now for Bridget Hillary and the News, the dramatic, true-to-life story of a girl radio reporter who dares to tell the truth in her hard-hitting weekly broadcast. As our scene opens, Bridget's father, Senator Murdoch C. Hillary, is just entering the rehearsal room of the Amalgamated Broadcasting System.
Why, Daddy, it's nice to see you. I didn't even know you were in New York.
Well, I just flew up from Washington on the 4 o'clock plane, Bridget. I was hoping to see you before you went on the air.
1 minute to airtime, Miss Hillary.
I heard a report down in the Capitol that you're planning to make some ridiculous charge against me in your broadcast.
Well, it's just the story about you and the postage stamp swindle. Now I guess I'll have to add another sentence to the story saying that you're up here cavorting around the gay white way at the taxpayer's expense.
Bridget, I'm not cavorting around the gay white way. I just came up here to try and prevent you from making a fool of yourself. I don't know anything about any postage stamp swindle.
30 seconds to airtime, Miss Hillary.
I just hope you're not going to ruin my career with some sort of ridiculous and unsubstantiated charge.
I don't like to hurt you, Daddy, but my duty to the American people come first. I just happened to take a good look at Washington's picture on a stamp the other day, and the portrait is the same one we used to have hanging over the mantel at home. And I checked back, and you were on the post office committee when the design for the stamp was approved. You obviously sold the government the portrait we had and then pocketed the cash.
That's the most preposterous thing I've ever heard of. The portrait we had at home was just a copy of a famous painting of Washington. Must be thousands of them around the country.
You're on the air, Miss Hillary.
Besides, your mother sold that picture of ours to the junk man 20 years ago.
Well, if you can show me the receipt from the junk man, I'll try to squeeze your side of the story into my broadcast. That's the best I can do.
Nobody keeps a receipt from a junk man for 20 years.
I thought that would call your bluff. You can rest assured, Daddy, that I'll do a very unbiased reporting job on your impeachment proceedings.
Government service has been my life, Bridget, and now you're going to blemish your own father's record with some loony charge like this.
Your program's off the air now, Miss Hillary. When you didn't show up in the studio, they filled the time with the soundtrack of a Joe Franklin program.
I guess I should have sent you on to high school the way your mother wanted me to. I thought a grammar school education was enough for a radio reporter. But I see now what terrible consequences of ignorance can be.
Just try to remember, Daddy, I'm not doing this to hurt you, but even family ties can't prevent me from fulfilling a journalist's duty to the American people.
And so Senator Hillary returns to Washington to face the charge stirred up by his own daughter. Be sure to join us next time when we'll hear the impeachment judge say,
"Well, I always thought Jefferson's picture was on that stamp."
That's in the next exciting episode of Bridget Hillary and the News.
And now, Search for Togetherness, the touching story of people just like yourself who struggle to find happiness in a small Midwestern town where the steel mill has been closed permanently. As our drama begins today, young Dr. Honeycutt is seated in his office upstairs over the cafe, where Agatha works part-time. Across the desk is old Dean Asbury of Roaring Falls Junior College. Suddenly, Dean Asbury leans forward and speaks with tension in his voice.
"I hope the results of my physical don't contain any bad news, Doctor. I know I've been working hard lately and possibly overdoing it."
"Well, to be quite frank about it, Dean, I haven't completely finished going over the results of your physical yet. I meant to get to all these papers yesterday, but I just couldn't do it. I guess I've been working too hard lately."
"Well, I don't mean to be unsympathetic, Doctor, but I am paying you quite a large sum of money for this complete physical, and I have every right to expect you to go over the results promptly."
"It may not be necessary to go over the results, Dean Asbury. I can tell you by the way your nostrils are flaring out that you're agitated. So I would prescribe a vacation, you know, just to unwind and relax. You've apparently been working too hard lately."
"Doctor, I certainly didn't need to take time out from my important work at the university just to have you tell me that. I don't mean to be unsympathetic, but I think you've been working too hard lately."
"It's interesting that you should speak of your work at the university, Dean Asbury. As we both know, it's not a university at all. It's merely a junior college. And yet, you're compelled to make it seem more important. A man like myself, who interned at the Menninger Clinic, It notices little slips of the tongue like that.
Interesting that you should speak of your internship at the Menninger Clinic, Dr. Honeycutt. I noticed from the diploma on the wall that you got your medical degree through a correspondence course. I wonder why you feel compelled to tell me you interned at the Menninger Clinic when you obviously didn't.
I'm sorry, Dean Asbury. I guess I don't know what I'm saying. I've been working too hard lately.
No, I understand. I've been working hard myself. Often it's 70, 80 hours a week, trying to catch up on the backlog of paperwork.
A man your age has to be careful about pushing himself too hard, Dean Asbury. I'd recommend a complete physical checkup for you.
Well, I thank you for taking a personal interest in my condition, Doctor, but I had a complete checkup just about a week ago.
Good, good. I trust the results are all within the normal range.
I really don't know, Dr. Honeycutt. I came here today hoping you might give me the results.
Well, unfortunately, I haven't had time to go over all of them yet. There's just so much to do around here, and I guess I've been working a little too hard lately.
Yes, well, I don't mean to be unsympathetic, Doctor, but if you can't give your patients the service they pay for, then, well, perhaps you should refer them to someone who can.
I think I'm quite competent to handle my professional affairs without a lot of coughing from the likes of you, Asbury.
That's strange. I'm just noticing the way your nostrils flare out when you're agitated. Probably means you've been working too hard lately. I'd suggest you take a long vacation, Dr. Honeycutt.
Perhaps I should, Doctor. But if you don't mind, I'll be the judge of that. Now, is there anything else before I give you an appointment to come back and get the results of your physical?
Just one thing, Doctor. And I've put off saying this for as long as I can, but I now have reason to believe that I may be the long-lost father of the notorious Snyder girl.
And so Dean Asbury finally admits his great secret that no one in Roaring Falls has even suspected for the past few months. But what will Agatha have to say about all this if she happened to overhear the conversation from the cafe downstairs where she works part-time? Perhaps we'll learn more in the next episode. Join us then for still more action-packed drama on Search for Togetherness.
You know what I want?
Okay, thank you, Stan. Good night. And that does it for Bob and Ray for this Monday.
Paul Hecht stars in the WOR Radio Mystery Theater tonight in a story called The Aliens, and it follows the Fulton Lewis News commentary coming up next.
So have a good evening, and we'll see you tomorrow at 4:15. Until then, Ray Goulding reminding you to write if you get work.
Bob Elliott reminding you to hang by your thumb.
And this is WOR New York, an RKO General Station.